Welcome everyone to the Goldster Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their fascinating and enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're exploring travel, adventure, and history. Please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, a count to five and we begin. Harry, and welcome. Hello and welcome to this Goldster conversation, wherever you are in the world or in the United Kingdom, which we're going to explore today with my guest, who is a soldier, an adventurer, and a pilgrim. What exactly is a pilgrim? What do you think it is? Put it in the chat if you have an idea of what a pilgrim is. There's no correct answer. Have any of you been on a pilgrimage? Maybe you have and haven't really known it. And how much does a long walk recalibrate the mind? And does it do it for better or for worse? With three books, we are going to go in the dolphin's wake, walking from Venice to Istanbul, then Like a Tramp, Like a Pilgrim, from St. Paul's Cathedral via Canterbury, of course, to the Vatican in Rome. And then we're going to get a glimpse into the future on A Road for All Seasons of our guest's walk around Britain, which will be published next year. What sort of society and British culture did he discover? Was he surprised, thrilled, or was he dejected? We all think we know our country, but do we really? And does it matter? Of course it does, because this is Goldster, where everything matters. And to help us find answers to some of life's most overwhelming questions, welcome Harry Bucknell to Goldster Inside Story.
Humphrey, thank you so much for having me on the programme. It's really very kind of you, and a great privilege to be here today. It's a real honour. Thank you.
Well, it's very good to see you in your book-lined study, Harry. It shows that you read some books. We have an answer about a pilgrimage from Diana M., a religious traveller. Okay, what is a pilgrimage, Harry, in your mind?
Well, a pilgrimage is a journey, no matter whatever method you go by, but a journey of devotion, where you're going to visit an icon or a shrine or say somewhere like even the birthplace of Christ or the birthplace of a saint or somewhere where a saint went. But the idea is that the journey is as much part of the pilgrimage as you're actually reaching your destination. So it is the journey in many ways that is all. In fact, Paulo Coelho said it is the road that enriches us. And I think that is very much the case, is the journey which is the forming part. In many ways, when you actually reach your destination, this pilgrimage, this, be it the Vatican City, be it Jerusalem, be it Constantinople or Istanbul, It is in many ways that is the anticlimax, because once you've got there, it's kind of over very quickly. It is what the journey gives you that prepares you for the arrival.
And I just want to drill down on it, as they say in America, a little bit. That does it have to be religious? Does it have to have or is it just a destination that you put there yourself in your mind?
You could be going to see Elton John play his last ever concert at Glastonbury. And that whole pilgrimage, the whole build-up, the whole excitement of the journey, the preparation for it, the going to, then actually watching him do it, that's all part of it. So you can be a pilgrim to Wembley Stadium to go and watch the Football Championship League. You know, it doesn't matter what you're going to see, but it's a pilgrimage. You're going to something specifically to experience something. And part of the fun is the build-up to it.
Okay, so you talk about Elton John, Wembley Stadium, great things, but there's some sort of spiritual element to it, an ambition. It's not just sort of getting on the train and going to Blackfriars to work in the city.
Well, no, it's not, and it is something where there's great anticipation that you will derive benefit or not necessarily from the experience. If you're going on a on a white coal walking, crossing burning coals, and you're going to do that specifically, it might be bettering your soul, but it might not actually be very pleasing for your feet. But it is an experience which you're going to benefit from in some way, I think.
And that experience is the journey. You don't have to walk it.
No.
You can go by Concord, or they doesn't exist.
In fact, when I arrived in Rome, my fellow traveller was upset that all these people had come by bus or by plane or whatever to come to Rome. My point was, it doesn't matter how they've come to Rome. It is that they've come to Rome that matters. And they're deriving as much from it as we are, and it's not for us to judge. We have walked all that way.
Now we've got a couple of ones in here which I want to talk to a bit, and then I want to go into your specific pilgrimages and talk about the four, I think, stages of pilgrimage that you touched upon there, and that once you get there, it's a bit of an anticlimax. But Gillian James says, St. James to Compostela, not sure of the spelling in Spain. Does that ring a bell with you?
With me? That is the journey of Santiago to Compostela. The Santiago being the St. James, the way of St. Jacques. I haven't done that route to Compostela. It is a very comprehensive route, a wonderful thing to do, because, of course, once you get to Compostela, you then need to go on to Finisterre, the end of the world, where you technically, you burn all your possessions, and then you are free of all sin. The great thing about all these journeys is that they are going back into the ancient realms, the medieval Catholicism. You are then liberated of all sorts of things. So I, for example, having been to Rome as a pilgrim, I am technically absolved of all sin. That's also, as I see it, which is a very good thing.
I took it, this is from Denise, I took a trip to Lourdes. After I got past the commercialism, I did derive some benefit from the experience. That's a very famous pilgrimage, isn't it, Harry?
It is indeed. But I think the commercialism is very key. It has always been such that every time the church or whatever announces a jubilee and everybody starts flocking to Rome, it is a chance for the Vatican or any church, it could be Westminster Abbey actually, to ring the cash till. It's a very good way of earning money, because of course the devoted come in their thousands, and they all want to be fed, they all need to take away souvenirs, and they all want to buy things to remember their journey by. The interesting thing is that in the age of iconicisms and relics, there were a lot of fake relics that people started making. So there were bits of finger and bits of bone. There weren't even necessarily bits of human fingers and bone that were claimed to be parts of St. James's or St. Audrey that or whatever. And they were blessed, and people then gave money because that's what they believed they were going to see. So there's a lot of fake, and that's probably still it seems to this day, a lot of fake things.
We've got a stone. I'll just do Gillian James, and then we're going to move on. Walsingham in Norfolk, and I believe there is a route around Canterbury too. Are you aware of this?
The Walsingham in Norfolk is known as the Nazareth of England.
Nazareth of England.
The Nazareth of England. I think if I'm correct in thinking about that. But of course, there are plenty of pilgrimages. Ely Cathedral to visit what's left of the tomb of St. Audrey or St. Ethelred. She died of a bubonic cyst, and she maintained her chastity throughout two marriages. And she died. She was then exhumed about 6-7 years later, and her sister who exhumed her found that she had the bubonic cyst on her neck had completely healed up. Her body was complete. It had not rotted or in any way, and her robes were intact. So they then took this as a sign of her miraculous powers. She was then moved to the church in Ely, but of course Ely Cathedral is built on the marshes.
Oh yes.
But it's a remarkable building in its own right. But then on top of that, of course, in the dissolution of the monasteries, Henry VIII's men then destroyed the whole her shrine, but it is still believed that the area has miraculous healing properties, and the pilgrims flock to the cathedral in their droves even to this day. But that's partly because also it is a lovely building. And with this, which is great, this enormous eternal aisle that goes down for miles and miles and miles. And then on top of that, the wonderful lantern, which gives it such light. I was thinking it has a lot of side of things because it's
sort of like a battleship on the Fenland, isn't it? Because all the land around it is flat. And I actually went up to the tower there once and looked down when they were doing the Evensong. Choir was singing the Evensong, and you had the summer's evening out there. It was quite magical. Now, I wanted to, before we're going to begin In the Dolphin's Wake, Harry, what is your religion? What is your spirituality? What is your search for healing powers?
I think that it is fair to say that I have a faith. I'm not a tub-thumping boring and Christian, and I have, and with all respect to that, I just have a faith, and I think it is important to have a faith because I'm no good man. I think that's fair to say. I'm no angel, but it is important to have a faith because that is the line in the sand from which we are, and it is good to be reminded of that. So I go to church once a month because it is as communion says in the Book of Common Prayer. It is meet and right so to do. In other words, it's a very, you can't get better than that. It's a proper tub-thumping good thing to do. And I think it's important to know where your moral compass stands. That's the line of sand. At least you know from there where you are. And I'm happy to say
that's a wonderful, if anybody agrees or disagrees with that, I love that thought that we have a faith which is a line in the sand. And then we can go either side of it as flawed human beings. But just if you're going to Wembley or an Elton John concert, does that constitute faith or is that something else?
George Michael would say it would.
Now, you have your four stages of, I've got four stages of pilgrimage here, but firstly, which are pilgrimage and then penance, resolution and grief you mentioned. If anybody's got any thoughts of that, please join in the conversation on the chat. But firstly, we'll get to that. But the Dolphin's Wake was you're walking from Venice to Istanbul. Firstly, why?
Well, if I make it pretty, it wasn't quite walking, it was traveling.
Okay.
5,500 miles through the Greek islands is a long way. I'm afraid, Humphrey, with all these things, I can't really profess to any great erudition on this. I had arrived in Mykonos and I was having lunch in a very good restaurant with my cousin, who was out there at the same time with his wife. And I said, someone should write a book about going around the Greek islands. And at the time, I used to review theatre. And my cousin's wife is a well-known journalist. And I said, Krista, you should do this. And she said, no, you're the writer. You should do it. So, of course, once you then get home and you start doodling on a map, then before you know it, you've created something. And then the seed is set. And then the next year, I set off to do this journey of a lifetime. And I didn't realize at the time what a journey of a lifetime it was, because I just thought, well, if you're going to go to the Greek islands, you start at the beginning, and that's Venice. And then you start at the end. You come to the end, which is Istanbul. And to get from one to the other, you've got to go through all these Greek islands and say, if you're going to do some, you might as well do the whole lot. So I did, I think it was 36 Greek islands in total. I've done about 48 now of the lot. But we managed to do every single Greek island chain. And then suddenly you get back at the end of it. And I'm not some chap who's sort of saying, now we're going to climb the face of Everest with just a safety pin and a bar of Kendallman cake. I like two things in relative comfort. And at the end of it, I summarize that probably not very many people have ever done this journey before.
Yes.
That is a real privilege, because then you realize it, that you have an understanding of the Greek islands from the Ionian right the way to the northeastern Aegean, through the Cyclades, through the Sporades, and all those wonderful islands. It was a real privilege. And I can only say, just a journey and a half. And I look back now, 17 years later, and you see, my goodness, what fun that was.
So, of course, I was really dumb by saying, did you walk it? Because you had to go by water for a lot of the way. So I'll withdraw that question. But the Greek islands have got a lot of sort of imagination and literature about them. There was The Magus by John Fowles that Leonard Cohen lived on Hydra. And I'm sure. So give us a Give us two tastes. One is a sort of historical one, because they were also, weren't they, the front line against the Ottoman Empire and the Knights of the Garter and that sort of thing. Give us that in a nutshell.
Well, the interesting is that Greece has only really has existed as an entity only once under Alexander the Great, and then since 1827 or 1830 thereabouts. And between Alexander the Great and the early 19th century, Greece was part of a huge thing, the Ottoman Empire, sprawling acreage, of which Greece at that time was had Muslims and Christians all mixed amongst each other, and they lived happily side by side. And so you get this sense even now, if you go to Hania in Crete, you'll see where the old mosques were. In Rhodes, the wonderful graveyards of the Mufti, where and this is where we seemingly slip into literature, where Lawrence Stowell had his house amongst the Mufti, amongst the graveyards, and his house is still there to this day. So you get this great sense of something wholly mature and magnetic about Greece, that it just sends the mind soaring into different thought as you think of the history from you know, Turkish troubles, whereas the Greeks threw off the Turkish shackle, the Ottoman shackle, not the Turkish shackle, the Ottoman shackle. And then you've got great stories of Derrien Dulac, Patrick E. Fermor, when he captured General Kuiper in the war and kidnapped him out of Greece. I mean, that was a mission that was fraught with disaster from start to finish. Just how on earth they managed to get it done was incredible. And then you've got, you know, a great artistic influence, like you say, Leonard Cohen, but actually people like Geeker, great artists like Geeker, and poets Odysseus Elitis, people like that who were just great literary people, great literary figures in their own right. Henry Miller, the American writer, yes. My mother too.
And did you? I mean, the way you describe that sort of reminds me of a slightly older, more mature Laurie Lee as I walked out one midsummer's morning, which we did a couple of years back here on Golster. I mean, was it like that? Did you just have a backpack and bumped into whoever you bumped into, or were you with a group of people?
No. I was very much wondering. I think troubadour might be stretching a bit, but I was very much this man with a rucksack. Went south, headed east, and kept going, and then sort of zigzagged around the Aegean. It was idyllic. There were various occasions where I had very set people to meet. I always find that in every book I write, since here I've been written to, I'm on my third, but there's usually some enormous gap, believe it. Someone says, oh, what a pity you didn't meet John Craxton on Crete. So I didn't meet John Craxton on Crete. John Craxton was, of course, was another great British artist who lived in Crete for many years and was quite a character. Of course, I just missed him. He was still alive when I was there.
And who was the most fascinating character that you bumped into unscheduled? So not that was on your list of people to meet, but just sort of captured your imagination.
I think without a doubt, my wonderful monk, who I met on Patmos, and then he took me up to Mount Athos. He was a great figure. Remarkably, he'd been a dancer in the 1970s for the Shah of Iran. People, he was a great dancer. And he had to confess that he actually was from Brighton. He said, "I'm from Brighton, really." And he was half Greek, and he, as someone to meet, became a very good friend. He became counsel, and he offered me an inner eye into Greece, which I wouldn't otherwise had. Actually, they're always meeting interesting people. Some of them were quite dangerous to know. Some were quite bad to know, but he was very good to know and enlightening in a way that I never would have dreamed otherwise. You know?
And you went to Istanbul. Did you have a destination in Istanbul to sort of touch something and then say, I've made it?
So it's interesting. I suppose really the Hagia Sophia. But the interesting thing about going to Istanbul, rather like my analogy about pilgrimage, is that is that when I got to Istanbul, it was a dampening experience. It's like, oh, I've got there now. That's it. And the sad thing was that I had taken the Friendship Express from Alexandroupoli to Istanbul. I thought this was going to be a great thing, and we were going to travel in great style. It turned out to be a three-carriage train pulled by different locomotives at different points throughout the night. We limped into Istanbul Central Station, which was a great thing to do, but the journey was behind me. And Istanbul is a remarkable city, but when you spent the last 6-9 months in the islands, which are a very intimate place, it just didn't compare at the time. But it was more of an urban to island shock, I think. That was a contrast that I find difficult.
And explain your choice and the significance of the Hagia Sophia.
Because it was now it is a museum, but it was at the time it was built by Constantine. It was the largest church known in Christendom. And so, as I've been traveling through Greek Orthodoxy, it was a natural conclusion where one should end up. But the Blue Mosque is as wondrous a building too.
Yes. Michelle Whitworth here says, I've been on long distance cycle routes, including parts of many pilgrim routes. I'm not religious, but there's something special about these historical routes. Yes, I disagree about arriving by Concorde, not by that ramshackle train that you mentioned. I think it's a very different experience to travel under one's own steam day by day with effort. What is your day-to-day routine? Is it all about where your next meal comes from, or how to get the next ferry, or?
Well, in Greece it was a bit different, because you get to an island and your first thing was you've got to get around the island very quickly, as quick as you can, and get a sense of it. So in some cases you want to find places that people will understand and they'll be able to have a rapport with, they have an understanding of. But then of course you want to find, I always think, you want to go completely the other direction and find the thing that they're least expecting to find, and that is what I always sort of concentrate on really more is find the thing that people are expecting to go for, and then find something completely different and off the beaten track that makes it more interesting, brings the place a bit more to life.
Thank you, Gillian James, for your message. We will tell you about the Isle of Iona after we hear the stories about going from St. Paul's Cathedral to the Vatican by Canterbury Cathedral, like a tramp, like a pilgrim, was your next book. How long after your disillusionment with reaching Istanbul did you embark upon this, and why?
That was quite quick. I mean, so Dolphin came out in 2011. That was 5 years after I'd written it, because it takes a few goes to find a publisher. But once we got into that, that was fine. So then a year later, 2012, I set off for Rome. And I didn't mean to go to Rome, except the fact that as I finished In the Dolphin's Wake, I literally put the last full stop on the final manuscript. A large cloud came up from the valley, and it started to rain. And then it let go one bolt of lightning, which hit the house, which I didn't think had been very well earthed, because I remember at the time watching as a spark came round the room, hit the side of my laptop, and then my laptop went up in smoke, literally, quite literally. And I thought, there goes 88,000 words of a manuscript. So what is an officer to do in this situation? Well, I went downstairs to make a cup of coffee. In those days, the Daily Telegraph used to be delivered to our front door. And while I was waiting for the kettle to boil, this is no word of a lie, I opened page 3 of the Daily Telegraph. Malcolm Moore, the Rome correspondent, had written a large article about the Via Francigena, the road to Rome. I went, that's my next book. And the thing was, that short of the heavenly host coming in, sitting in the sitting room, which is quite a small space, would have been quite tight, what other way can you say you were told to go to Rome by the good Lord above than when your house was struck by a thunderbolt? So I was smote by lightning, effectively. And that's what sent me to Rome. And it is no word of a lie, I promise. That's how it happened. And then suddenly my publisher said, you're going to Rome next week. I went, what? No, next week. And I thought, I'm not. Off you go. And that was that. And that's how the journey began. And I still think to this day, that if there's a hand in anything, well, that's how a whole sequence of events will start as a result.
Did you rescue the Dolphin's Wake manuscript, though?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because there's usually someone when I give a talk is waiting at the end to say what happened. Because I really, really lost about 50 words, because no writer work this still doesn't back up. So, luckily, I was about 50 short. But the whole screen died, and I had to take it to someone, get a new screen put in, and it burnt out a whole series of the system. And quite bizarre, but I'll never forget, it was as if a blue light troubled up that little card, the cable, and into the laptop. And
I know the feeling, Harry. I had a laptop stolen at Heathrow way before the day of clouds and things, and 75% of a manuscript was on there, and I had to rewrite the whole thing.
Yeah, I never forget watching two Japanese girls arrive at Victoria Station. They put their bag down, and they put the laptop on top of it, and a whole 120,000 words thesis just got nicked. That was the end of that. All things, they were in shock, tears, I mean, meltdown. Nothing is going to happen. But you have to, as a writer, you have to back up all the time.
Yes. Geeta says that your experience there was meant to be, because a few months or weeks or whatever later, you were on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yes.
What happened?
4 days. I wasn't the fastest pilgrim. In fact, my friend Raoul and I, we were the youngest on the route by about 20 years, and we were the slowest. But I took the view that it's not a race to get to Rome. It is a journey to be enjoyed, to be savoured. So I did take my time wandering around looking. I didn't know what I was putting off getting there at the end, but it was a great thing to have done, and a real privilege too. But we talked about the four parts of pilgrimage. Obviously, there's preparation. The first half of the actual journey itself is penance. It's like, your mind is in turmoil. You're going through this constant sort of, you're trying to sort of leave the normal world behind. You strip your whole life down to a stick, a rucksack, and a hat, and your boots, and your clothes you're wearing. And life becomes very simple. But you keep thinking, I've got to be there by so-and-so. I've got to make that corner by that time. Then you suddenly realize, about halfway through, when you've got to this is literally almost, just as you approach the Alps, Lake Lausanne or thereabouts, you then think, I'm halfway now. And then suddenly this sense of calm comes over you, this absolution that, and then your mind sort of settles into what needs to be done when you get back, and you've worked out your life. It's like pressing restore settings on your laptop. And you think, oh, thank goodness for that. And then the next half of the journey is absolution. The trouble is, you get to the end of the journey, and you realize that all these people you've walked with, all these people who are there with you, they're not there anymore. And what are you going to do now? You're going to go back to normal. And that's rather a chilling thought. And you have grief for the journey, because it becomes a great part of your life. For 3 months, you've done nothing but get up every morning, get to the next place, explore the next place, meet new people, get up the next morning, go to the next place. And so you get on, and you're gradually, bit by bit, achieving your goals and your aims. And it's a slow, steady slog. It's like writing a book, actually, in that sense.
I mean, it's interesting, because you say when you leave, your mind is sort of getting rid of all this rubbish that we have in about, I have to interview Harry Bucknell at 12 o'clock, so I better clean my teeth and that sort of thing. But when your mind settles, so when you lose the rough and tumble of life that we're on, that's not a vacuum and a grief. But when you have to get back to it and get to your destination, then you do have loss and grief at that settled bit of your mind. Is that
you miss your life? You realize it. Life, you can live life very simply, and you don't need all these encumbrances like microwave cookers, like air fryers. You can, or your gym. It was my gym membership. I cancelled it. I hadn't cancelled in the right week or something. They were chasing me for one more month. So I was thinking, I just left right in the country. But you know, you had to pay it. And there was an issue. It's sort of rubbish like that. The sort of things that this is the daily grind of life. And you think, it's rather like, have you updated your Oyster card or something dark?
Yes.
Like that? Well, I'm not going to use another thing. And your life is pared down to what it should be.
And you prefer that, do you?
Yes, well, because you get, because when you're on a pilgrimage, you're a ward of church. You're going from hostel to hostel, or to church house to church house, or to convent or to monastery. It's very simple, your life, and your thoughts are really with the surroundings. You can't do something like that and not get caught up in the whole spirit of the whole thing.
And you don't get bored?
No, you don't get bored because. So I talk about cutting down life. I took an iPad, an iPod with me. So you find me in lone woods and so on, dancing down rides and so on because no one can see. Suddenly, you realize there's a tractor driver that's following you. And he's wondering what on earth you're doing, but actually you're having a bit of downtime. So you can let yourself go. You can do things that don't necessarily know. If I was wandering down Salisbury High Street, booting away my iPod on, people would be kind of...
Gita is an interesting question. Do you feel lonely when you're home? Do you feel lonely?
Yes, I do. Yeah, as I do. I get. I find that although sometimes I crave my own loneliness, a lot of times because you're writing about people. Your writing is all about who you meet along the way. You're writing about what you see. It's about experience. And sometimes at home that can get quite, because you're writing about new things. Remembering things, you get lost in that, and you hanker for it hugely. I hanker hugely for being outside at times. I get very at times. The black dog is a feature of my life, but I always think in a way that the black dog is a feature of your life because without him around, you have these highs and lows. That gives you the creativity. So melancholy at times is part of the deal.
And it's a bit like your moral compass, is that you set where your black dog kicks in and where your optimism kicks in. And that, Gillian James, I think we're talking about the tramp pilgrim. Did you walk through Switzerland or go by bus and train? Did you do Switzerland on that?
Did I go by bus and train? As a pilgrim, you are on a bound to walk. It doesn't mean you have to, but I walked every step of the way to Rome.
So you walked to Rome completely, whereas in Dolphin you had to take the ferries and the buses and the trains. This was a much truer pilgrimage.
Well, because it was a pilgrimage, a proper pilgrimage, a dedicated pilgrimage to Rome. So in my new book, A Road for All Seasons, the idea was that I was going to walk all the way, but quite quickly became apparent that it would take me a lot longer to walk 6,500 miles, which it ended up being. Didn't start out to be 6,500 miles, ended up being that. But in order to cover the ground from Iona to Dover, it took me 6,500 miles through the journey. But in so doing, I could have walked a long, long, long way and not met anybody at all. And the aim of the game is to meet people and to understand Britain today. So I took trains, planes, no, I took trains, buses, cars, taxis, the whole lot.
I want to get to Road for All Seasons in just a second, but I want to nail down the tramp pilgrim thing, and also a couple of other interesting questions that have come in. But you went from St. Paul's Cathedral to Canterbury Cathedral, and then to the Vatican. What is the Canterbury Cathedral? Is where Thomas à Becket was killed on the misinterpreted instructions of Henry II? And then did not Henry II make a pilgrimage down to the cathedral?
Yes. Who rid me of this damn priest is the alleged line that he gave, and then his knights took him at his word. Thomas à Becket was not a religious man, essentially. He'd been Henry II's chancellor. He had fought alongside the Battle of Quercy, and when Henry announced he was going to make him archbishop, he said, you do realize that means, thinking, I think, that Thomas would be in Henry's pocket, that he said, you do realize that I will be in opposition to you for the rest of my life. And within a matter of months, he was in exile. Because the church was then the only opposition or the only check on the absolute rule of monarchy. And, of course, it was the Church of Rome, which meant that constantly... There's a double allegiance to the Pope and to the Church in Rome, and Thomas saw that as his duty to do that. So he eventually came back, and he knew he was going to die, And he knew that the knights were there waiting for him. But what Henry didn't appreciate, I think, was the devastating effect that would have, and still has this day, about the method of his murder. Because he was murdered at evensong, while at prayer. He was murdered on the actual spot. And where, you know, his brains were spattered across the altar, and the knaves kicked, you know, his gore and so on in to the side. It had reverberations around the world, and I think it was that atonement which Henry paid for in due course, and I think it did rid him of this damn priest. It put Thomas on the map. Within minutes, his body was hung, was quartered, and relics sent across the globe. But it meant that Canterbury was the most visited shrine of Britain. In many ways, St. Thomas should be the patron saint of Britain, not of England, not St. George, because St. George was a Palestinian Roman soldier. Mm-hmm. So, but St. Thomas was our man specifically. Again, like St. Ethelred or St. Audrey at Ely, Thomas's grave and tomb was ransacked during the dissolution of the monasteries.
So the Canterbury Cathedral is now, if I'm wrong, it is the capital or the heartland of the Anglican Communion. Is that right?
This is
where, you know, the Church of England world, the Anglican world, all around the world, Canterbury is their place that the decisions are made.
And so technically, the pilgrimage to Rome starts in Canterbury.
Yes,
if you're going from Canterbury to Rome, you should go from London to Rome, because I thought that seemed better. But I cracked on a few hundred miles at the beginning.
So did you get sort of blessed or whatever by the Dean of St. Paul's or the Archbishop of Canterbury, and then by the Pope at the other end?
I got packed on my way by the Dean of St. Paul's. I got packed on my way by the Dean of Canterbury Cathedral, and off we went. And you did feel very special, because as a pilgrim, you're a ward of church, but it's not just straightforward to take all your time, as I sort of intimated earlier. You're actually back within a year and one day. Otherwise, your chattels and goods can be distributed amongst your family. And I wasn't too keen on that idea yet. So, so you had to get a move on. But you're a ward of church. You're allowed free passage. You're exempt from all taxes, which is always has its attractions. Of course, that's in the medieval times. And of course, for going to Rome, as I alluded, you are awarded huge amounts of indulgences, or you were in the Middle Ages. It was a very, very good thing to do. You couldn't just nip off. You had to get permission from your bishop to go off in the Middle Ages. But I was excused all that, I think, because I'm...
So you walked through, basically you walked through Europe, or as far as it is to get to Rome, going through all sorts of villages, societies, cultures. You then walked around Britain, which I get to in a second, but give us a nutshell of what you discovered about Europe during that walk.
So France is a very large country. And lots of France, you see, these lovely little villages and so on with their lovely little tabacs and cafes. You can walk for many, many, many miles and not find a tabac or cafe, because they all go to the Carrefour, which is 10 miles away. And of course, in a motor car, that's just 2 minutes. But that's a day's walk if you're on foot. So that was one thing about France. But also this majestic, huge rural state. I mean, it is vast, and there's lots of it, and it is beautiful to see. I think the most impressive part for me were the mountains. Switzerland was like the California of Europe. It was young, it was vibrant, full of money, but it was so expensive that you literally shot through Switzerland as fast as you could do because it was so expensive. And yet, once you got through, when you got to the up into the Alps, the only thing was walking upside alongside the Rhone, the River Rhone. How the River Rhone was, with all the meltwater, was 2 or 3 degrees cooler there than it was walking away from it. So it's like walking with a head in a fridge. But you got to the top of the Alps, you got to St. Bernard Pass, and you dropped down into Italy, and it was like arriving in the biggest cocktail party, because everyone in Italy wants to talk to you. You get the sense of vibrancy, you get the sense of party, and they're just wonderful people. But then you go, you're in cross town, and you get you think you've done the Alps, And then you come across the Apennine Mountains, which I crossed with this wonderful Swiss guy called Rita Schulter, who was a Swiss teacher. He said, these little mountains, and they are little sharp needles. They are steep like that. They are not to be underestimated. And then, of course, you arrive by the coast, and it's just wonderful to think you've walked all that way. But there's no great sort of, now I'm going to walk to Rome, sort of 1,400 miles about it. You just do 10, 15 miles a day. There's no great, there's no great Chris Boddington, I've scaled Mount Everest. It's just you steadily doing your bit by bit, slowly, and enjoying the journey on the way, because it's the journey that reaches you.
How many pairs of boots do you get through on a 1,500-mile journey?
Three.
Yeah. So how do you break them in, Harry? I mean, because
luckily,
you can't just start with a new pair of boots, can you?
No, you can't. So the modern boot today is more like a trainer. So you haven't got so much to worry about. And I like these Salomon boots. They're big and broad. You're not going to wear them for fashion, but they're very easy to wear, and they're like trainers. You can wear them immediately, so you haven't got to worry about that so much. That's the joy of modern technology. But equally, it doesn't mean to say you're not going to get blisters. So I got blisters. There's no logic to blisters. It suddenly appears. You think, why is it suddenly appear today, tomorrow, or the day after, or nothing for three weeks, and suddenly away you go. You learn to live with it. By the time you get to it, everybody's got some form of hobble, funny ankle or a limp or whatever. You carry it.
You can. And then when you got to the Vatican, and you got a document or something there. What does that document say?
Testimony. It says Harry Butler was here. It's on a piece of paper, and I haven't got it to hand, I'm afraid. But it has the picture of St. Peter and St. Paul, and it is written. Your name is written in there, saying that you in Latin. So. If you like me, you didn't get very far in Latin. You don't understand what it says, but basically it says that it is your testimony. It proves you've been to Rome. I didn't meet the Pope, and I didn't think at the time that I could adequately express how it might be to meet the Pope. I just felt it was best not to meet him, because I think it would be again. You couldn't adequately put into words, which is what our job is as writers to do, how it would be to meet the Holy Father, having got that.
And then you've reached there, and then your grief, loss, your black dogs kick in. Yeah. What happens when that happens?
Well, so I took off the Greek islands actually for 2 weeks.
I
wanted to just have a complete break, and you do need to decompress because it's quite an intense experience. And then for 94 days you walked all this distance, you thought nothing about getting there, you get there, and then whoosh, it's like away, and there's a great deal of celebration takes part. I can't confess that I didn't have a drink or two when I got to Rome, and then you get back into life, and it takes a bit of time just to readjust, And it's a bit like when you've been living abroad and you come back to the UK again, and you sort of think, 6 weeks ago, I was living in Cyprus as we were when we first met all those years ago. And you think, I live there really, I didn't really live. But actually, you've got to get back into life and settle back in. And you realize that everybody else lives that life too. We all get on with it, don't we?
Yeah. We have a couple of thoughts and questions here. A quick answer. Did St. Augustine have something to do with Canterbury from Gillian James?
He did indeed. That was where he first established his first, when he first arrived, when he was sent from Rome. That's where he first set up his church.
Okay, that's and Gillian also would love to go on a pilgrimage, but have mobility issues now. Lords, I think they have, wheelchairs and mobility scooters and that sort of thing.
And I. There's no reason. You don't have to walk, you don't have to ride, you don't have to bicycle. It doesn't matter how you get there. It is the fact that you try to go there at all. So there are plenty of ways of getting. I mean, even if you flew to Rome, and then had someone pick you up and then took you, in a taxi or whatever to the Vatican. It's still allowed. It doesn't matter how you got there. It is that you got there at all. And indeed, your effort in many ways is greater than someone who has the mobility. So don't give up on that one. It's a great thing to do.
That's great. Now, Gillian, again, but earlier on, we are now going to A Road for All Seasons, which you began on the Isle of Iona. Where is Iona? Why is it significant? And why did you start there?
Iona is, it seemed to me that a journey of this significance, traveling the lengths and breadths of Great Britain, I was going to start on the Isle of Mull. But when you've got the Isle of Iona just off Mull, it is probably one of the westernmost points of Scotland, the British Isles. That seemed to be the place to start. You're going to ask me the question now as to what saint was there. And of course, typically, as I answer this question, I can't exactly remember. But it was where the Iona community was one of the first set up in England, or in Scotland, rather, to spread the word of God. And it seemed to me that starting a journey of this size, 6,500 miles, it was right and proper, meet right and so to do, to start it in Iona at the abbey where the monks had started to spread the word of the Lord into Britain.
Okay, so you started and then you zigzagged. I mean, it wasn't like a Land's End to John O'Groats walk, was it? Just tell us where you went.
The reason I zigzagged was because Bill Bryson had just done the Bryson line. So he'd cut a line through Britain. And I thought, well, I can't do that. I've got to zigzag around. See if you can see that very well.
Yes, yep.
He's starting there in Iona.
Right.
All the way down to Newcastle there.
Right.
Via Dumfries and Glasgow. And then up to Belfast, not shown on the map here. And then from there, I cut a swathe right the way across Britain, from Aberystwyth all the way across to Alderbury over there, and then back into London, down to Bristol and Plymouth.
Yes.
Into Dover at the very end, and if you can see that. I think my map's the wrong way around, isn't it?
No, your map comes through to me perfectly well. And how long, that was 6,000 miles, was it? And how long did it take you?
It took me a year. I'll tell you exactly what the detail is.
And how many pairs of boots we need to know now?
Only two.
Two? Well, you said it was three for the Europe walk.
But don't forget, I wasn't walking all the way. See?
Okay.
So the exact detail is it's 6,518 miles from Iona to Dover through all four nations of the United Kingdom, including 42 counties and 23 cities, requiring 75 trains, 26 cars, 16 buses, 9 ferries, 4 tubes, 4 Uber cars, 4 London taxis, 2 Doctors Light railway journeys, 2 vans, a canal boat, a probation service minibus, an intercontinental articulated lorry, and 1953 Morris Oxford, more than one pair of boots.
So what percentage of that was by foot?
I think about 20%.
20%. It's quite a bit, because Gita has a question here. Does it chill your mind to be with nature? You would have walked through some very beautiful places.
Does it relax me? Yes. Sometimes does it frighten me? Yes. Because to walk with nature, sometimes you're right in the outdoors. But sometimes you can be at threat from that. So if you run out of water, like I did on the hill in Siena, outside Siena, you can very quickly die if you can't find water. I mean, it was as simple as that in the heat. I think it was fair to say, when I was in the Derbyshire, in the peaks in Derbyshire, on the other occasion, I was worried about getting caught out in the dark, and because I had tarried along the way, and I hadn't perhaps wasn't quite as prepared as I should have been. I think walking along the Seven Sisters, the most marvellous walk of all Britain, I think. But the trouble about that is you're actually very careful about hitting the edges because these are sheer cliffs. And if you get 10 to 15 foot close to the edge and a parapet shears off, that's you. You're hitting the deck. You're falling off the cliff. So you've got to be careful. Right? So you can admire, you can enjoy, but you must always respect your surroundings and understand what you're in, who, where you're about, because and if you're prepared, that you might get into trouble.
You are English or British. You've served in the army, so you fought for Queen and Country, or you served Queen and Country. You would have had a preconception of what your country is like we all do. What surprises did you find about the country that we live in?
I think the poverty was what struck me more than anything else. The areas of poverty that one came across in places like Glasgow, in places like Hartlepool, that struck me because all around there's great wealth, and suddenly you come across these pockets, these completely forgotten areas of Britain, it feels at times. And that was perhaps what struck me most. It struck me how...
Describe the poverty. What did you see to know that it was poverty?
You get a sense of just hopelessness often, whereby in, say, a place like Sunderland, when you leave Newcastle, you're travelling to Sunderland across the bridge. Clydeside and places like that, you just get an instant sense of just the way people are clothed differently, the way they feed themselves differently, the way they are. You just get it's awful to say, but there's a look about it, and you just get the sense at times of just hopelessness. There is nothing in the area to enliven or offer hope for. And people are stuck with their lot, and they don't know necessarily how to get out of it.
And when you talk to the people there, what stories did you hear? What mindset did they seem to have?
Well, at times they're resigned. At times, you just get the sense of that they've given up on life, and they expect or they rely on government to provide, and so benefits play an important part in their lives. To overcome drugs addiction, these are all important things that are going to give them the leg out of life. But often it's a downhill spiral that they can't get out of that. That's very saddening. And also at the same time that you come across other communities which you don't realize because of how we live our initial lives, but we all do. But when you get to places like Leicester, these vibrant Hindu and Asian communities, which are amazing to meet, come across. The Hindu temples there, which should be set in great acres of parkland, and are actually stuck on a four-lane highway. But these are amazing, wonderful architectural gifts, really, where they brought Indian grass from him, and they fashioned marble and built these amazing temples and temple complexes. Remarkable to see.
And this isn't a political question, Harry, but I feel I have to ask it because you've gone through Europe and you've gone through Britain. Is our culture and our thinking different to that of Europe, or are we Europeans like the French or the Italians feel they're Europeans?
Well, I think we were, and I think we. We are lesser now. Personally, I think that is a sadness, but we are where we are, so we have to look forward to that.
Yeah, but I'm thinking more sort of, there's something, that island mindset spirit that we have, and our history is slightly different, isn't it?
Yes, but we are indelibly a part of Europe because of our position, like it or not. The channel, the sea around us, has been to our advantage and has been to our disadvantage. So that we have this body of water around us makes us instantly different. But we are essentially European, and it is to Europe that we'll always have ties and links, because that's the closest landmass to us. We are, in that sense, indelibly linked to it. I think. Yes. And I think, but I do think that I'm not saying there's a right or wrong trip, but there's definitely been a change in attitude to our approach to Europe, where before we were much more welcoming, now we're much more isolationist.
And as you're, this is the last question, then we're going on to our promotions, but just sum up for us then your 6,000-mile journey. Give us the top line in two or three words of what sort of country Britain is.
I think it is a journey through Britain, through towns, through cities, and an understanding of Britain today, which has been an eye-opener and a revelation and a joy to undertake and a privilege too. Highs and lows are a very long way.
And do you sort of feel when you go through, we talked about the monasteries, Ely Cathedral earlier on, do you feel that is all part and parcel of what you saw?
Very much so. Although I think Britain is increasingly secular and rightly so, these great religious institutions and I add into that the great mosques and so on in Bradford, they're all part of the make of our country, because again, coming back to the moral compass I talked about, the religion, no matter what religion, it provides the moral compass. It is the line in the sand by which we are understanding everybody else's approach to that. They're all frighteningly similar. They're all lovingly similar. And they are great institutions. They're all part of our land and culture.
Stay there for a couple of minutes. I have to tell our wonderful audience and members what is coming up next. First of all, Geeta, I think it has reminded us that when you're dealing with black dogs, Kath Temple is a regular on Goldster. Tune in to, she's got a 6-week special course going at the moment. Tomorrow, Book of the Month. My book of the month is The Bullet That Missed by Richard Osman. That's the multi-million best-selling sequel to the Cozy Crime Thursday Murder Club. The Elderly, laced with wisdom, experience and humour. That's at 12 o'clock. No recording. You can say what you want. What's said on Book of the Month stays on Book of the Month. My future books will be The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad and Jonathan Livingston Seagull by Richard Bach. So read them and join us on those later in the year. Tuesday, August 29th, I'm with Corrie Mapp, the amazing story of a young Barbadian who badgered his way into the British Army, lost both legs when his vehicle ran over a roadside bomb in Afghanistan, and 3 years later, he represented Britain in international sports. Purpose, passion and grit, you've got it there with Corrie Mapp next Tuesday. August 31st, I'm live at Riverstone Theatre in Fulham and on Zoom, of course, with the brilliant psychiatrist Dr. Ben Cave, and his new book is What We Fear Most. Email Joe Carter-Hawkins or concierge@goldster.co.uk if you can come, and you can ask Ben what it is that gives us anxiety and fear. And of course, black dogs, we've discussed so much during today's show. September the 5th, I'm with the remarkable Alexander Scrimgeour, who trained under the very best mentors in Vietnam on his book, Facial Reflexology for Emotional Well-Being. That's an incredible story. September the 7th, the brilliant Second World War historian Roger Morehouse returns to Goldster with his new book, The Forgers, a Second World War operation that saved thousands of Jewish lives by smuggling in forged documents so they could escape. And on September the 8th, I'm with the wonderful Michael Arditi, a totally brilliant writer, and his new book, The Choice, is set in a country parish, which gives us stories of deep moral choices. That's a book about moral compasses, I think. Any of those grab you, Harry?
Well, I Corrie Mapp, you have a fascinating conversation with him. I mean, remarkable story there. And I think also the Forger sounds fascinating because you know, anything whereby these are tales of great daring do and to try and get your documents past anybody, especially even then, is remarkable. Really. His tale is one of humility and triumph against adversity. I mean, remarkable.
That's, and now, although you're a young man, Goldster's demographic is for the wise, experienced, the elders, and that. and as a pilgrim and adventurer. Now, what tip do you give to those who might wake up with a bit of the black dog, wondering what they're going to do, empty nesters, retired or whatever? Give us a thought.
I would say, first of all, is get out of the house and go for a short walk and engage somewhere on that walk. Say hello to them. Say good morning.
That is a brilliant piece. Short walk and say hello to somebody. Get out, exercise, be interactive. Time's winged chariot attacks us. We cannot fight it off. Thank you, brilliant audience, for your questions and for joining Harry and myself for our journey through his journeys. Until tomorrow with the bullet that missed, stay safe, stay reading, stay curious, stay involved, keep walking, be a pilgrim. Thank you, Harry Bucknell, for sharing your stories and being such a bundle of inspirational fun. And we all fought off the black dogs. I'm going to call you a guest for all seasons, on a road for all seasons, and we'll have you back next year when that comes out. Until then, bye everybody. Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.